Before I begin, I have said in the notes on my website that I'm certainly not claiming to have a very deep acquaintance with the work of Lacan. I've read much more Deleuze and Guattari, and I have tried to pin down what it is about Lacan that they want to oppose. That still is my interest, and it clearly means I have been selective in my occasional reading of Lacan. I can only offer a few points that might start to clarify things a bit. Obviously, much more reading of the originals and the commentaries will be required if you want to really get to the bottom of the controversy. Meanwhile, let's jump in. It should be said right from the start that the main model of language we are going to be criticizing in several plateaus is the one that dominated French thinking and to some extent Anglo-Saxon thinking as well, and it's normally known as structural linguistics, associated with Ferdinand de Saussure and having great application in social science through the work of Lévi-Strauss. An anthropologist, I've got some notes on my website of Lévi-Strauss's very persuasive demonstration power of a structural analysis of kinship systems. We find in A Thousand Plateaus occasional discussion of Chomsky's linguistics as well, especially the apparent claim that a universal logical structure lies at the heart of all transformational grammar. The main proponent of the French view for Deleuze and Guattari, however, is Jacques Lacan. As I've said, I'm only an occasional light browser of Lacan, and I must say I find him really difficult to read, probably for the same reasons that Deleuze, Guattari or Foucault are difficult to read. As I mentioned in the introduction, they are all exponents of a particular kind of French elite academic discourse, full of all sorts of allusions and implicit references to other philosophers, but also to writers and musicians. In addition, Lacan's work is particularly densely strewn with words in French, German, Latin and Greek. I was reading an important essay on the phallus in Lacan's main book. Well, you know me, I normally anglicise the names of French terms, and if I were doing that, I'd call it Lacan's écrits. But even I can't bear to do that, so I'm going to call it écrit. That essay summarises the argument by quoting two untranslated Greek words in Greek script right at the end, for example. The material is really only for those with no pressure from university assessment, with financially secure leisure, and with very good access to online dictionaries and commentaries, and even then it's formidable. Although Lacan is rarely mentioned explicitly in A Thousand Plateaus, I suspect that quite a lot of the casual throwaway discussions of actual examples that you find, which range from comments about stickleback behaviours to interpretations of paintings, are really part of an argument with Lacan, and obviously we'd need some decent commentaries to pin this down. The structuralist model of language is criticised on two grounds, and we're going to divide them into political and theoretical grounds, although the two are, as always, linked. Let's start with arguments about the political effects of this model. Structuralist linguistics offers a particularly abstract conception of language, and again it is one that offers simple rules and options for analysing communication, despite the highly varied contents of such communications. In Lacan, the language of both the psychiatric patient and the analyst can be grasped by the model, for example. We can understand all forms of communication in terms of basic universal components, especially the signifier and the signified, and there are a few operations on these components that describe most acts of communications. One is the construction of narratives. Another turns on the use of metaphor or metonym. In metaphors, the meaning of a term is creatively extended or displaced by suggesting an identity between two separate terms, saying, for example, "The moon was a ghostly galleon." That's a poem I had to learn at school. With metonyms, The meaning of something is condensed so that a part stands for the whole. Marilyn Monroe is described as a blonde, so her blonde hair stands for the real person and all her supposed characteristics. If we describe her as a blonde, we are recalling her bubbly personality, her combination of naivety and sexiness, and so on. I'm not implying for one minute that real blonde women have these characteristics. Well, I've actually been summarising Lacan's definition of metaphor and metonym here. Freud uses words like displacement and condensation to describe the processes going on in developing the imagery in dreams. And what Lacan is arguing is that these are directly translatable into more conscious linguistic operations using metaphor and metonym. It's not surprising, perhaps, that for Deleuze and Guattari, this makes structural linguistics a perfect conception of language for modern abstract capitalism that also transforms reality into simple and abstract terms. For example, it represents the value of commodities by their price in the market, and then suggests fixed rules of exchange for them, the so-called laws of the market. And it doesn't matter what these commodities are or what they're actually used for in reality. Modern capitalism also increasingly concerns itself with adding meaning to the various goods and services it provides. It engages increasingly in linguistic or semiotic activity. It adds signifiers, extends metaphors, generates images. Well, language like this constrains our creative thinking, including our thinking about new, more liberating forms of politics. Right from the beginning, when children learn a language, they also acquire what Deleuze and Guattari call, and I quote, order words. That is, information about their place in social relationships and their social obligations and what counts as appropriate social behaviour. I have an audio file that explores that concept a bit more. I think it's probably the next one. Children develop as individual enunciators and thus come to think of themselves simply as individuals in social terms. They come to acquire an understanding of social authority, and they also form an understanding of the world based on the conventional words that are used to describe it. Conventional language implies that things can easily be given a simple name and understood in simple sentences. And this is the so-called objective illusion that events and objects are neat and simple, with dominant meanings expressed in a single word. Well, we know that events and objects for Deleuze and Guattari are rather different. They have both virtual and actual components, for example, and we saw this in the discussion of the Hexeity. The whole process linking language to social order is understood as an openly political one for Deleuze and Guattari, arising in definite social conditions involving domination. Whereas in Lacan and other structuralists, it seems to be part of some universal form of human development. In fact, far more pessimistic political implications follow from that position, as we shall see. We can see the dominating effects of conventional language more locally as well. In the criticism of conventional Freudian psychoanalysis, which is a major interest of Guattari's, we see clear examples of using forms of language which actually involve dominance. The utterances of neurotics or psychotics are to be reduced to the classic terminology of expert analysts, for example. There's a common criticism, which they have developed extensively in their earlier book, Anti-Oedipus. Freudian analysis insists that ultimately many neurotic symptoms can be understood as arising from some infantile struggles over identity in the family. This is usually summarized as the Oedipal complex. That is seen as a universal form, central to developing the human personality in socially acceptable ways. The approach in Deleuze and Guattari is to see the struggles of neurotics and psychotics quite differently, more as attempts to raise and explore philosophical issues about bodies and social constraints, and to work towards alternative understandings of themselves as singularities. Well, we saw something of this in the Plato on the Body Without Organs, with the thoughts of Antonin Artaud, or in the insistence that sexual experiments like masochism are not just perversions, which is how Freud would see them, but explorations of bodily potentials and pleasures. In the second Plato, one of Freud's most famous patients, the so-called Wolfman, tries desperately to convey to Freud something about the importance of multiplicities in explaining animal and human behavior. He does this by referring to a group of wolves in his dream, alluding to the wolf as a pack animal, and pack animals show emergent characteristics arising from collective behavior. They're not just individuals. Freud seems unable to understand this point and treats his patient as a self-contained individual. In some other discussions, including some in Anti-Oedipus, a case discussed by Freud, the unfortunate Little Hans, is seen as a child trying to explore his own rhizomatic connections between his immediate family and all the activity involving horses and men working at a busy depot that he can see through his window. For Deleuze and Guattari, this can be described as Hans becoming horse. However, the poor little chap is crushed back into the Oedipal triangle and is made anxious and agoraphobic by his uncertainties about sex and reproduction, the standard Freudian account. In Guattari's own work, and I'm referring here to the Guattari Reader edited by Gnosko, I have some notes on that if you want to read it. There's a more general application too, in that all sorts of minorities, including sexual minorities, are labelled as perverted or neurotic by conventional psychoanalysis. Instead, they have to be encouraged to see their identities as singularities, particular options within the general forces that construct subjectivity. Turning to more theoretical issues, the problem with structural linguistics is that it does not refer much to the actual reality that surrounds the use of language. It's too formal and abstract, and it misses out important aspects, especially of actual language use. Well, I'm going to explore that in a subsequent audio tape. Let's take Lacan as an example again. The criticisms in A Thousand Platos follow from more extensive criticisms in Anti-Oedipus. Now, clearly, there's no time or space to pursue these very far, but one main focus turns on Lacan's view of desire and how it works. And to be very brief, desire for Lacan is rooted in both basic needs and more complex social demands. Actually, somewhere between the two. That's what he says in Écrit. Needs, demands, and desires all have to be symbolized, however, expressed in language and acted out in relation to others. Sexual and family relations are excellent case studies where we can see this happening in some detail. In infancy, for example, desire becomes attached to a powerful signifier, the phallus, a symbolic penis, and so the whole mystery of desire and its connection with other people becomes symbolized as a puzzle about who possesses this phallus, who can initiate desires. The phallus is so central it becomes a master signifier. That means it can come to symbolize relations with a very wide range of signifieds. In Anti-Oedipus, this whole structure is challenged. Instead of direct connections between signifiers and signifieds, we have a whole number of connections or conjunctions, rather exhaustively listed number, between desires and their objects, and they don't all operate through conventional language. Desire itself is not just a simple matter of sexuality, but more a matter of flows of more general energy, and as we would expect, it is machinic. That is, it offers many potential combinations of these flows. It will only be channeled through conventional language or the Oedipal triangle in specific circumstances, and that will only be one option. Desiring machines also contain many more possibilities, both realized and applied, because they connect together quite separate or heterogeneous elements. We will be on familiar ground if we remember that the term desiring machine was eventually replaced by the notion of assemblage in 1000 Plateaus, and we know how they work. By breaking with the Lacanian system, we also break with Lacan's insistence that there must always be an alienation or lack accompanying desire. That lack arose because subjects are never able to fully grasp with signifiers their objects of desire, both their own objects and those of others. The notion of a desiring machine with its complex conjunctions seems to imply that there is no one simple perfect connection in human desire to be found out in the first place, and so no permanent feeling of lack or alienation if it is not achieved. Instead, there is a great deal of pleasure and recognition of your own singularity in exploring some of the available connections. Any alienation arises from the connection of desiring machines to social machines. Capitalism clearly requires the regulation or repression of desire, and Freudian and Lacanian psychoanalysis are complicit here, because what they do is spell out the apparently independent internal dimensions of this repression in the mental activity of individuals who have to live in capitalism. Well, I've undertaken a brief and occasional reading of Lacan, as I've confessed, and it's clear even from that human language simply dominates all the other available meanings. There are other realms of meaning, such as the imaginary, with a capital I, but they are all totally dominated by the realm of the symbolic, with a capital S, of language. You might note, if you didn't know already, that Lacan uses capital letters for these terms to indicate that he's using them in a special technical sense. So, human beings might indeed experience bodily affects from real-life processes. They also experience having to deal with a range of images, impressions, or general models of material and social reality. But as soon as they want to elaborate and develop any of these meanings, they are forced to use symbolic language. As soon as they do, they have to obey the rules and conventions of language use, and these are external to them. Language use is the basis for relations with other people as speakers and listeners. The linguistic reactions of others, including those apparently located in the unconscious, are crucial in developing our sense of ourselves. At the level of individual psychoanalysis, patients can only ever describe their symptoms in conventional language, and analysts can only inquire about them using conventional language, albeit a slightly tweaked version. It's only a short step to see psychoanalysis itself as nothing but a matter of deciphering the language of psychiatric patients. Well, following that up, to grasp that language, we need to understand linguistics, and Lacan chooses structural linguistics, especially what it tells us about the relation between signifiers and signifieds combined in the sign. Well, human language offers many sophisticated literary forms of combining signs in actual speech or writing. We've mentioned metaphor and metonym, but there are all the other literary manipulations as well, and Lacan lists them. Well, I'm going to use English rather than the Greek words he uses to talk about things like attempts to persuade, to project meanings onto others, to use irony, exaggeration, inversion or compression, and so on. In all this, we also have to remember that the signified is not a real object or event, but an expression in speech of a concept about the real. It follows that reality itself, outside of language, cannot constrain us, and we can only know it through language. Expressing or establishing meaning then becomes a matter of developing acceptable relations of various kinds between signifiers, both signifiers themselves and their relation with signifieds. These expressions can be very complex ones, and we can see this particularly well with the accounts of delusions in psychiatric patients. Schreiber has left an account of his illness, a rare example of a written account, and it's both lengthy and coherent. And even though it's describing miracles and inner voices, it resembles academic work in its well-worked-out arguments. If you're ever tempted to read a bit of his memoirs, chapter 15 is perhaps the best example of this style. Lacan went on to describe all the conventional understandings that divide self from other, the conscious and the unconscious components, the thinking ego and the acting ego, as linguistic relations. To cite the famous slogan, "The unconscious is structured like a language." In another slogan, one that particularly annoys Guattari, social interaction is also entirely linguistic. The human subject is only a signifier for other signifiers. Now, I found a nice simple, if perhaps misleading, example of this argument in Lacan's Seminars, Book 15, where he refers to the well-known work of Pavlov in conditioning a dog to respond to a noise. A lot of people think this is a bell, but it's also a trumpet, apparently. And as you'll probably know, when Pavlov makes the noise, the dog eventually learns to salivate or produce some other gastric juice, even in the absence of food. This is a classic act of successful communication, says Lacan. The only significance the human subject, Pavlov, has for the dog is as a source of signifiers, noises in this case, and received as images, not human symbols. The only significance of the dog for Pavlov is as an emitter of other signifiers, gastric juices or saliva, and Pavlov then elaborates them as symbols or symptoms of something. We relate to others only via the exchange of signifiers, and satisfactory relations with others depends on them receiving our signifiers and responding appropriately, and vice versa. We have to remember that our own egos also talk to internalized others, and this is how we maintain and reinforce our sense of reality. Well, we've already implied that the linguistic and symbolic world is already structured before the infant acquires it, and it's structured by social and political relations, obviously. Power over others depends on being able to monopolize the master signifiers mentioned above, one of which is the phallus, and the other famous one is the name of the father, all hyphenated. This seems to support the notion that patriarchy or phallogocentrism is some kind of natural order for Lacan, although there's much debate about whether he was actually endorsing current systems. Zizek, in particular, says he was not, but most people seem to agree there's actually quite a lot of ambiguity where the symbolic phallus and the actual male penis, or the name of the father and actual fathers, seem interchangeable. I must say, for what it's worth, that when I read the article on the signification of the phallus in Ecre, I was struck by how much of it seemed to be located in the sexual morality of bourgeois French society at the time. There is a strong implication, for example, that conventional heterosexual conduct is the norm, and when we see the sexual morality behind a lot of the description of differences between men and women, and also the forms to be taken by marital infidelity. He's rather apologetic about male infidelity in particular. What we have here is quite a common finding, that existing forms of social relations seem to have been taken as universal ones. However, Lacan's arguments present a real problem for anyone interested in liberating people from the current social order. Social order is introduced to us in infancy and is preserved at a very deep level of our personality. We structure ourselves and our relations to others through dominant language. We can't rely on altruism, philanthropy, idealism, social reform, or pedagogy, because they're all underpinned by, Lacan's term is, aggressivity. Not just aggression, but the potential to generate aggression. That's a reference to écri again. The best we can do is to try and understand this process and come to terms with it. Well, as you might imagine, feminists aren't terribly keen on this approach, and a recent prominent feminist psychoanalyst, Bracha Ettinger, has looked for a much less hierarchical form of relationships with others in forms of language and meaning construction that were in place before infants make a full entry into dominant language. She says this was suggested by reading Guattari. These infantile relations, very young infants, were much more maternal, reciprocal, and shared. Well, it's plausible, but I think Lacanians would have few problems in saying that no access to these forms of communication are possible unless we go through adult language to describe them, in this case, the specialist language of the feminist analyst. Well, for Deleuze and Guattari, the project to get beyond Lacan is a bit more extensive and has two major thrusts, if you'll pardon the phallic reference. First, to revive forms of language and meaning that coexist alongside the symbolic. In this way, we deny the symbolic its monopoly. Well, we've already looked at animal communication in Plato 11 on the refrain, and we're going to examine what might be called natural forms of communication when we look at Plato 3. There are also artificial languages, which consist of special signs in internally coherent systems, something like maths or computer coding, and these do not symbolize or signify conventional social meanings. They are, to use their terms, asignifying. There's also clear interest in experimental forms of writing or in other arts, as shown in Deleuze's books on Proust or on Francis Bacon, or the work on experimental cinema and in the jointly written book on Kafka. Deleuze's The Logic of Sense explores apparent nonsense, like Lewis Carroll's work, and the radically experimental languages of schizophrenics, like Artaud or Wolfson. These all make sense. The second thrust involves restoring the proper social dimensions of language in collective assemblages of enunciation, shifting away from the dialogues or dialectic dyads between self and other. Okay, I'm going to explore those a bit later in the audio files that follow.